From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, we'll learn about efforts to improve the health of Milwaukee's rivers. Later, a Milwaukee man works to open a sports center with a level playing field.
We would have accessible equipment there that whether you're able-bodied or disabled, you could get in and use, and now everybody has the chance to be on a level playing field and play together.
Wauwatosa launches its first-ever all-city read featuring two books. Organizers say it's about community building as much as it is about literacy.
Whether they've read the book or not, they're welcome to participate. So some people might participate and then read the book, but we kicked it off early enough, hoping that people will pick up a copy or find a free copy and read the book, and then they'll have things to connect to their neighbors in the next few months.
And we'll also chat with the author of one of the books included in the effort. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The health of Milwaukee's rivers is improving, albeit slowly. Earlier this month, the third annual report card from the group Milwaukee Riverkeeper gave the quality of the Milwaukee River Basin a C-. It's a low score, but actually a slight improvement over the D-plus given to the 900 square miles of the KK, Menominee, and Milwaukee River watersheds. The authors of the report point to chronic water quality impairment, thanks in part to remnants of legacy contaminants released well before the Clean Water Act was crafted. There are actually several area organizations who are actively monitoring river quality and seeking to improve the letter grade on the next report card, as WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz reports.
Cheryl Nunn coordinates more than 80 volunteers who troll the Milwaukee, Menominee, and KK watersheds. Milwaukee Riverkeeper started the citizen monitoring program back in 2006, adding some standardization where little existed.
We have a multi-structured program where we bring in volunteers kind of at an introductory level and train them how to use more simple equipment and in kind of the biology and the techniques that are necessary. And then we elevate them to an advanced program. And in that program, people are using essentially DNR equivalent equipment and DNR protocols, and they even get a login where they can put their data directly into the DNR database. So we set up several years setting up the program, and then in 2010 decided, you know, we need to do a much better job of actually disseminating that information to the public and trying to make it understandable what we're finding in the river, what the river's telling us, and what they can do to help us get to where we want to be, which is, you know, a clean, fishable, swimmable river.
Nunn acknowledges that the challenge of conveying the complexity of the basin's water quality is made even trickier because the most up-to-date report reflects data from 2 years ago.
We've had some people wondering why it's taking so long, why we haven't released the 2013. And it kind of goes to what I was talking about before. It takes us a while to do quality assurance on the data to make sure that the data is correct. We also, in addition to our citizen data, we do collect DNR data, as well as MMSD data. And MMSD also goes through a long process to make sure that their data is accurate.
How do you check that?
Part of it is just making sure what's in the system matches up with what's in the data sheet that was taken in the field. Part of it on our end is also visiting our volunteers with redundant sets of equipment to make sure that when they're going out there, in a lot of cases with meters, you know, looking at oxygen and pH, and that we're getting the same result.
Nunn says looking back at 2012, the basin's baby step improvement from D-plus to C-minus likely resulted from an extremely dry summer rather than human effort.
In a lot of different ways, the water quality was improved, I think, because of the drought.
Why would drought improve the water quality?
Oh, that's a good question. So in a lot of our really urban watersheds in particular, they're very dominated by urban runoff. So basically stormwater that's running off the street and, you know, off of our yards and our homes and, you know, going into the storm drains and then dumping into the river. And so when there is less runoff, because we don't have a lot of rain, there's a lot less urban runoff into the river. So I think that partially explains why we saw improvement.
Nunn is quick to add, Milwaukee's three watersheds continue to be hit by multiple pollutants, including phosphorus.
And phosphorus comes from fertilizers. A lot of that has actually been phased out of residential fertilizers now, but the farmers still are able to use phosphorus in their fertilizers and in some cases golf courses. Even in a drought year, you know, we would have thought or hoped actually that we would have saw some, you know, improvements in phosphorus because there wasn't as much rain. But we still had, you know, a lot of major phosphorus problems in 2012. And I think some of that is because, you know, there's still a lot of it just in the system that's like hanging out in the sediments. And the rivers, in a lot of cases, because there wasn't rain, were warmer than normal. And so that did cause a lot of nuisance algae blooms in 2012 that I have to say were pretty significant. We had a really significant algae problem on the lower Menominee, which I think a lot of people will remember, probably the worst I've seen in 12 years, where we like to see a downward trajectory in a lot of our pollutants. We're seeing upward ones.
Bacteria levels from human waste, Nen says, are up. Suspended solids, such as sediment and other debris, threatens critters that live in streams and the streams themselves. Nen says you can see its culprit on our snow-covered urban landscape.
You know, a lot of times in the spring and the summer, you don't notice it as much because it rains and all that stuff washes down the drains and goes right into the waterways. You know, when you really drive down the street right now, you just see the blackness that's out there and how really, you know, gross the roads get and the sidewalks and everything. You know, a lot of that dirt's coming just from the land. You know, it's coming from urban land uses. You know, a very high percentage in the Milwaukee Basin is construction, huge loads of sediment in construction sites that aren't well managed and maintained. And in some cases in the upper Milwaukee, still quite a lot of sediment from agricultural use as well.
But Nen says there are positive stories. Upstream, banks are being stabilized, while downstream, stretches of cement channels are being removed. A regulatory framework is also in the works that Nen says will put our rivers on a pollution diet. It's called TMDL.
It means total maximum daily load, a federally approved plan that's binding by law, basically saying, okay, we're not meeting standards for phosphorus, and we're not meeting standards for bacteria, and we're not meeting standards for sediment. As part of that effort, we've really been able to target where there needs to be pollutant reductions in different portions of the river to meet these standards. There's a lot of different groups, the DNR and MMSD and a lot of different stakeholders that have been working on these TMDLs along with a lot of nonprofits to come up with these plans. So entities that do discharge pollutants into the river, whether it's a municipality or a company, are going to get new limits put into their permits eventually that will help us ratchet this pollution down. I think that's really exciting. So over time, we'll be able to really focus our money and our efforts to reducing the pollutants to get them to a level where, you know, we think they're going to be safe to be used.
As the TMDL program rolls out, Nen says Milwaukee Riverkeepers volunteers will continue to test and monitor their assigned stretch of the basin. She takes the long view on the time it might take to transform the Milwaukee River Basin to a fishable, swimmable state. So, too, does Kimberly Gleffy with the River Revitalization Foundation, or RRF. Her office sits at the southern edge of a community-driven effort to create 870 acres of trails and restored habitat called the Milwaukee River Greenway. She says its implementation will stretch out for decades, but Gleffy already feels its cumulative effects.
Every improvement we make in the river valley will improve water quality. So I think Riverkeeper's report card and River Revitalization Foundation's land restoration, habitat restoration, and shoreline restoration is only going to enhance habitat and improve the water quality of the river.
RRF's most recent tangible step is a one-mile stretch of path.
We received an easement from Milwaukee Area Technical College where their solar farm is. And once we had the easement recorded, then we went in, we had to do a trail design and get the permit from the DNR, and then we went in with Student Conservation Association and volunteers and students to actually physically construct the trail.
The process stretched out over 2 years.
Probably the longest amount of time is negotiating an easement and getting that all approved legally. Once you have the easement and all the permits, the trail was constructed in like a month.
Aaron Zaleski has just come on board to help take the Greenway vision a step or two further.
Implementing signage, working with landowners to close gaps in the trails, working towards a habitat plan and doing ecological restoration and coordinating that throughout the whole 800 plus acres.
Meanwhile, conservation biologist Gary Casper is working to regenerate wildlife hard hit before the river's revitalization. Casper specializes in amphibians and reptiles. He started taking inventory of snakes on the Milwaukee River over 6 years ago, but says he's learned a lot since.
Well, first of all, there's only three species, which is not good. I mean, there should be more. So things like water snakes have disappeared from the riverway, but potentially could be brought back. So the snakes we are finding are the Butler's garter snake, the common garter snake, and the brown snake. And these are typical urban snakes that are pretty tolerant of development and manage to persist. But in this situation, the Butler's garter snakes outnumber everybody else. Then the brown snakes, and the common garters are real rare. So we've marked, you know, several hundred garter snakes, and we're learning more about their movement patterns, how long they live, how fast they grow.
Casper also implanted about 40 garters with reflector tags he tracks with radar.
So we were able to walk around with this radar unit and try to find the blips, and we're finding snakes in situations that we had never found them in before.
Including in the woods, rather than the grass, where they're normally found. And they're feeding on things that are affected by water pollution.
Well, the butlers eat almost exclusively earthworms. Okay. Which in this situation are probably highly contaminated with toxic sediments that they eat. So it's been interesting to see how the snakes can feed on this contaminated earthworms and still have good population.
Snakes, of course, are just one piece of the ecological puzzle Casper looks at from two endpoints. What did the habitat look like before Milwaukee became Milwaukee, and compare it to what's left today, with an eye toward creating a habitat plan?
Try to figure out what we can do to improve things, increase biodiversity, get some more of these species that people really like to have around actually living and breeding here. So like with the frog community, went from, we suspect, 8 species pre-settlement to 2 today. Salamanders went from, we suspect, 4 species pre-settlement to none today. So those are groups of organisms that we could reestablish. There's just certain things that have to be done to support them, which aren't here right now.
So what would have to be done, Gary?
Well, with the amphibians mainly, it's about getting some of these wetlands back, especially the temporary isolated wetlands that they breed in. There's a few spots we've started to identify where it seems feasible, but it'll take stakeholders to come together and make it happen.
It makes you wonder what kind of impact Casper's vision would have on a future report card. For Like Effect, I'm Susan Benz.
Susan Benz is WUWM's environmental reporter. She spoke with conservation biologist Gary Casper, Kimberly Gleffy, and Aaron Zaleski of the River Revitalization Foundation, and Cheryl Ment with Milwaukee Riverkeeper. A unique sports facility is looking to get off the ground in the Milwaukee area, and we are not talking about a potential replacement for the BMO Harris-Bradley Center. We will hear what we are talking about next on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Our next segment is about a remarkable community resource. There's just one catch. It is not yet built. But if Damian Buckman has his way, it will be within the next couple of years. But let's take a step back. In fact, step is the operative word, because the people for whom the Ability Center will be most useful can take a step neither forward nor back. Buckman himself suffered from childhood cancer and almost lost both legs, but he grew up to be an active, athletic adult and wanted to give others the opportunity as well. His vision is to build a community sports center for people of all abilities, disabled and able-bodied. Back in December, Buckman told Lake Effect's Bonnie North that the Ability Center is based on the concept of reverse inclusion.
We live in a world where we build things that are supposedly accessible for those with disabilities through the ADA code of law. The Ability Center is really about being inclusive and designed universally for people with disabilities while inviting in the able-bodied public. So it's a complete paradigm shift of the way we see things and build things today. And actually, if something works for those with disabilities, it absolutely works for those who are the able-bodied public.
So now the Ability Center is, it's a gym, right? Is that the basic idea?
Yeah. A gym sounds pretty generic. Yeah. But the vision is actually the first of its kind in the U.S. It entails 230,000 square feet. And to put that in perspective, it's like the size of a super Walmart. And it's about fitness. It's about athletics, swimming, running, the whole bit. It's more of an athletic facility with a fitness component versus which you'll see in most fitness areas are a fitness facility that happen to have a court. So we're kind of the reverse of that.
So the idea is to get everybody doing something physical.
Absolutely. Everybody having access and opportunity to that same level of being fit, active, and healthy that their able-bodied peers do. And that's exactly what the basis is behind the vision of the Ability Center, is giving that same daily opportunity that says, I don't want to have to go at the time that's scheduled for me for my practice or a program or whatever that is. It's 1 o'clock. I'm on the couch. I'm bored. I want to go now. And that's what the Ability Center's goal is a daily opportunity to be fit, active, healthy, and to play.
Besides some of the obvious reasons why people with disabilities can't do that, what are some of the things that are there that are obstacles that we who are able-bodied might not realize?
I think, essentially we as an organization and myself have boiled it down to two words, and that's two that I've already mentioned, which is access and opportunity. So it's first of all very important that you have access to the necessary adaptive equipment to use, and that could be whether it's a physical disability or an intellectual disability, that you actually have access to the equipment that's modified to your special needs, whether that's athletic equipment, cardio equipment, or strength equipment. But then once you have access to that, you have to have the opportunity to use it. So there's great organizations out there like the Challenge Athletes Foundation that gives grants to people with physical disabilities to get, say, a prosthetic running leg, to get a wheelchair, a sport athletic wheelchair to use. But it doesn't matter if they have that wheelchair or that leg if they don't have a place to use it. So that's where opportunity comes in. The Ability Center giving that option, that space, that accessible, inclusive, affordable space to actually use the equipment that either you have yourself or that we would provide for you at the Ability Center.
Now, what about the people who will be working there? Is there special training that goes into working with athletes who have disabilities?
What the Ability Center will have is not just a personal trainer, but that personal trainer would first be experienced in recreational therapy and or physical therapy, and then on top of that, have the accreditation to be a personal trainer. So they first understand the body and needs of somebody with some form of disability or a special need more than they understand the general human body and the way that that works in its perfection and completion and just the idea of the concept of an able body, then this is the way it was supposed to work. So they would have the knowledge of special needs of individuals before they had the knowledge of just how to train a normal working body, if you will.
Do you see this as being, you said, sort of an athletic center first? Mm-hmm. Are you imagining teams? Are you imagining some sort of Ability Center, uniform that people will be wearing going out into the community?
Yeah, I think that would be amazing. I mean, within the Ability Center and within our DNA lives collaboration. So one of the biggest things that we're not doing and our focus is not going to be is to reinvent the wheel. We want to enhance the wheel that already exists. There's already great organizations out there like Special Olympics, Milwaukee Recreation, Great Lakes Adaptive Sports Association. These are organizations that are providing adaptive services to people with disabilities, but they don't have the space and time to do it, let's say, during normal business hours, slash 18 hours a day. So we want organizations like that to come in, use our affordable, accessible, inclusive space in the Ability Center and actually enhance the programming that they already offer. So we do envision teams. You may have seen the Guinness commercial recently that came out. And we've been very flattered by the number of people who have tagged us on Facebook or emailed or asked us if we saw it because they are starting to understand what the Ability Center is about. In that commercial, there's a bunch of gentlemen playing wheelchair basketball. And at the end of their wheelchair basketball space, all but one stand up after their game. So all these able-bodied individuals were actually playing with their one disabled friend, and they had the first opportunity to play together because that's the same concept of the Ability Center. We would have accessible equipment there that whether you're able-bodied or disabled, you could get in and use, and now everybody has the chance to be on a level playing field and play together. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for that recreational space, that opportunity where you can just come and play. Because most adaptive sports are competitive. And believe me, I'm uber competitive. But in any demographic, there isn't a large percentage of individuals who want to be competitive, who want to have to practice a couple nights a week, who want to travel around the country to have to play. So they really just are looking for that same opportunity to just recreate and just have fun.
Social leagues.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely social leagues. I used to run a sports facility in Waukesha. It's what my professional career was. And we provided the opportunity for youth volleyball, youth basketball, adult volleyball, and they had the choice of multiple hours a night, multiple days a week to come and play and be in these social leagues. When I realized that that opportunity isn't out there for people with disabilities, I started to have a sincere problem with that and say, this is a problem that's easily solvable. We just need the space to give them.
So where is this space going to be?
You know, we're hoping to build in Milwaukee County, potentially somewhere around the medical campus in Wauwatosa is the goal. More than anything, because it doesn't matter how accessible a building is that you make or you build, if people can't access it, they have to be able to get there. And while it's on the outskirts of Milwaukee County, it's still within the confines, and it's off of the heaviest traveled bus line for the transit system. And then there's the transit plus van line system that people with disabilities use. And so they would be able to access the campus through that as well. So in the entirety of southeastern Wisconsin, there's 190,000 people who report a disability. 100,000 of those in that seven-county radius are in Milwaukee County. So it's vitally important that we're in Milwaukee County to serve the most need and fulfill our mission, but also to be accessible to that transportation piece and start to eliminate barriers. So, you know, Milwaukee County Transit goes all over Milwaukee County, but the question starts to become, how many transfers does one have to make from bus to bus to bus until they can actually get to that location? So being somewhere near the medical campus would actually eliminate numerous needs for transfers. And it would also be a one transfer from Waukesha County Transit to Milwaukee County Transit for Waukesha County individuals in order to access the Ability Center.
How close are you to actually breaking ground?
Our timeline right now is we're going to be launching our capital campaign somewhere between the spring and fall of 2014. We hope to then break ground in the spring of 2015 and be open by the summer of 2016.
Okay, so pretty ambitious.
Pretty ambitious, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
And how has support been so far?
The support has been great, truthfully. People are looking for that one big domino to fall, and once that falls, it's literally that dominoes thereafter. Philanthropists out there, community leaders see the vision, understand the vision, believe that there's a tremendous need for it. We recently had a conversation with a community leader who nailed it on the head when he said the Ability Center could be a jewel in Milwaukee's crown, and he couldn't be more right. The vision of this is not just about an athletic and a fitness center and a place for people to play, but ultimately to collaborate with an institution such as the Milwaukee Regional Medical Center to conduct research on how do we train people with disabilities, to become the ultimate goal to actually Ability Center certify locations around the country. So, you know, at times I've likened the vision of the Ability Center to the March of Dimes, right? March of Dimes was founded to cure polio. They did that. And then they found a new cause. I look at the Ability Center much like that. If we are able to Ability Center certify, whether it's Wisconsin Athletic Clubs or YMCAs of the world or the Gold's Gyms of the world or the 24-Hour Fitnesses of the world, where they become more accessible to their community and those with disabilities in their community, that pushes our members out of the Ability Center doors, we would have fulfilled our mission.
Why do you think that this has not been approached in this way nationally before? Why is Milwaukee on the forefront here? Is that you?
Interesting question. To some degree, I believe it's me. You know, the backstory with me is I actually have an ambulatory disability myself from childhood cancer. I'm 1 in a billion survivor of my diagnosis. I've had 32 surgeries since I was 13 years old, 22 knee replacements and revisions since that time as well. I live in the possibility every day of my life of becoming a bilateral above knee amputee. And that's where the passion and the drive and the vision comes for the Ability Center. I was eventually, after a surgery, forced into wheelchair sports. For a while, I was able to play and manipulate the little bit of ability I did have standing up to play volleyball. When I finally had a surgery to be in less pain than I was currently in, that took away a lot of my ability. And so I was forced for the first time to get in a wheelchair and play wheelchair sports. And I fell in love. And then that's when I realized the opportunity for me to play anytime was existing for me to play volleyball was no longer an option. It was unacceptable. It was not okay. So to some degree, I think the vision of the Ability Center and myself as its founder are the driving force, certainly in Milwaukee. And sometimes it takes that dreamers that's not okay with the status quo. I recently watched the Steve Jobs movie, Jobs, and I was not aware of his quote where he made a comment, something along the lines of, the people who are crazy enough to believe they can change the world are the ones who usually do. And that's so true. That's so true. I have for 4 years held this space that the vision of the Ability Center can change the world. I have for 4 years held the space that the purpose of my survivorship, where doctors thought from Milwaukee here at Children's Milwaukee right here to Sloan Kettering Memorial in New York, didn't think that I would make it to my 15th birthday. And because I've made it to my 35th birthday and beyond and here coming up, I absolutely believe that my purpose of survivorship is to deliver this vision of the Ability Center. And it's hard to stop somebody who has a belief.
And, you know, Damien, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll come back when it opens. And maybe we'll do a tour around and talk to some people who actually are coming in to play some sports.
I think it would be amazing, right? It would be great to get you in a wheelchair and kind of discover what some of this accessibility stuff is we're talking
about. To me, that's the interesting part, too, is getting able-bodied people to understand what you both lose and gain.
Absolutely. Well, sometimes we talk about the wheelchair, or the sport wheelchair, for example, and we liken it to a pair of shoes. So in order for a general able-bodied individual to play basketball, they need a $50 to $100 pair of shoes. Well, that pair of shoes for somebody with a physical disability is $2,500. Who's got $2,500 in their back pocket to buy that pair of shoes?
Yeah, not
me. We want to be able to support that. We want to be able to provide that there at the Ability Center for anybody to get in and try.
Well, again, I wish you the best of luck, and thank you so much for coming in today.
No, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Damien Buckman is founder and executive director of the Ability Center. He spoke with Bonnie North in December. There is more information about the center and its plans at wuwm.com/lake effect. It's been a long, cold winter, and people in Wauwatosa are curling up with a couple of good books. But the idea is to get them out of the house. We will learn why when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. It's hard to find reliable statistics about the number of book clubs in America, but it seems safe to say that there are tens of thousands of them, maybe many more than that. There are specialty clubs in areas like romance, science fiction, even religion. The city of Wauwatosa, though, is taking the book club concept one step further and hoping to engage nearly all of its residents in the city's first ever all-city read, featuring two books, one for adults and one for younger readers. The program, which ramps up later this month, features scores of activities from book discussions to less conventional ideas like writing and even painting workshops. Maureen Batting and Robin Luther are among the lead organizers of the Tosa All City Read, and they're with us in the studio to share more about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Is the All City Read about literacy or community building or something bigger than both of these?
I think it has to start with community building because it came as an idea out of the Neighborhood Association Council. We are an umbrella group that assists all of the 29 neighborhoods in Wauwatosa develop their membership and develop their activities and strengthen their neighborhoods. And as a council, we thought, what could we do to help with that? Our ideas in the last years have been to put on some all-neighborhood events, all-city events, that the neighborhoods can utilize to build their membership and engage their neighbors. And our other big event is the Tosa All-City Read. That was an idea that came up, and then Maureen jumped in and chaired that event, which was great.
Well, and so what was it about reading that you thought would bring – I mean, this is not the first All-City Read. I mean, there are other cities that have done this. What was it about reading that spoke to you as a way to build community?
We looked at what our neighborhood associations were already doing, and a lot of them have book clubs and very popular book clubs. So we thought that's a great way to bring people together. And the whole movement of common reads across the country, that's their purpose, is to do community building. So it just seemed like a great match.
Well, what was it about Rocket Boys and Hollow Earth that made them the ideal titles? There were a number of many others that were nominated to be part of this read.
We started with an extensive list.
Yeah, we had a very interesting process because we did want to involve the neighborhood associations, and so we asked all the book clubs to make suggestions. And then from there, we narrowed the list down and presented it to a panel of experts, and that was librarians, booksellers, English teachers. They ended up reading six books, and then it was just unanimous. Everybody loved Rocket Boys. It just has so many themes in it that are interesting to people of all ages. We wanted something that was of broad interest.
Well, and tell us about, for people who are not familiar with the title, it's a memoir.
It is. It's Homer Hickam, who was a NASA engineer, and he, in the late 50s, was inspired to set off rockets as part of the space race. The Russians had beat us into space, and his teachers and principal had encouraged the kids to do something about that. And he and his buddies took it upon themselves to build their own rockets, and the whole community ended up getting involved.
So you chose Rocket Boys as the adult title, but this is an all-city read that you're trying to include younger readers as well. Hollow Earth has some good Wauwatosa ties.
It does. It's it's co-authored by John and Carol Barrowman. Now, John is an actor that works mostly in the UK, but his sister Carol is a Wauwatosa resident. She teaches at El Verno College and writes for the Journal a couple times a month. So it was just so wonderful to have her available to help us with the read. And she's the book actually has some of the same themes in it of community, using imagination to make wonderful things happen.
Family,
right. Yeah.
So what came together to make this possible? I mean, the Neighborhood Association Council was the driving force behind it, and obviously the literacy effort is behind it as well. But it's one thing to get librarians on board. Who are the other people and groups that are a part of this? Because it's a really remarkable kind of coalition that you've built behind it.
We have a very diverse committee of different people who are very active in the community, and everybody brings a little bit of a different flavor to the committee and has a different tie-in to retail and to schools and to neighborhood groups. And we're getting very strong participation from lots of different people, not just a library-focused kind of activity.
I think the most remarkable thing about the whole process is we got two wonderful sponsors who had complete faith in us.
Right.
Before we even had a title chosen, Shore West Realtors, Meg Fox and Kathy Cox, supported us, and then North Shore Bank came on board, and they've just been wonderful because they just go with the flow. Whatever we crazy events we decide we want to do, they have been going along with it.
That's right. And they both are right in Wauwatosa in the neighborhood, and they came in with good financial support that we can really have a lot of fun with this event.
Well, how's it going to play out?
Well, we've been trying to get the word out. We actually bought 50 copies of each book and have been stocking them in cafes and little free libraries around town. We had a kickoff celebration at Barnes & Noble. So once the book is out, and the book clubs are all on board, they're all reading it, but we want to get other people involved too. So we're still trying to get the word out. And once people have read the book, if they don't have a book club that they're involved in, they can come to one of the book discussions we're sponsoring. And if they do have a book club and want to come, they're welcome to come to that too. And then we've just got a whole bunch of fun events planned.
Well, and I would imagine you would want to make it about more than just book clubs, because if it were just a book club event, then the people who read the book wouldn't necessarily make these broader connections.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's for everybody. And there'll be different ways for everybody to participate. Whether they've read the book or not, they're welcome to participate. So some people might participate and then read the book. But we kicked it off early enough, hoping that people will pick up a copy or find a free copy and read the book, and then they'll have things to connect to their neighbors in the next few months. And our rollout of activities is basically the month of February. We have a whole calendar of activities.
Well, and what strikes me about those activities is that they're part of this read, but they aren't necessarily all about reading. Tell us about some of the non-book club discussion kinds of activities that are going on.
Well, I think probably the most fun is, and we'll get a lot of play on this, is the Battle of the Bartenders. If you are associated with a book club, you know that food and drink is a big part, is almost as important as the book that you're reading. And so we're brainstorming ways to come up with ideas to help book clubs do have a special food or drink. And we actually will be posting recipes from Colwood, West Virginia on our website. That's where Homer Hickam is from and where Rocket Boys takes place. And that's the food element. And then the beverage element, we thought it would be fun for some of the major bars in town to compete as bartenders making rocket fuel, their own rocket fuel concoction. And so that will take place throughout February. The cocktails will be available at restaurants. But then at the end of February, we'll have the competition with celebrity judges.
And I saw there's a painting workshop that dovetails with Hollow Earth as well.
Right.
Which is a book that plays out as the characters are able to animate their paintings.
Exactly. And then if they're in trouble and they're being chased by nefarious characters, they can draw a painting and hop into it or paint something that will protect them. So the painting workshop is a great, great connection. With Rocket Boys, the writer's mother, Elsie, hated living in a small coal town in West Virginia. So she painted a huge mural of a beach scene on her wall and would sit and drink her coffee and look at it every morning. So we're going to have a beach scene painting.
Is there something to the idea that this is playing out in January and February when most of us are really ensconced in our warm houses?
Very much so.
It was very deliberately planned that way, yes.
We wanted to be after the Super Bowl, but during a very quiet time in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
Are you hoping that, that you can build off of this to do subsequent all-city reads?
We would like to do this every year. Yeah.
This is the first of about 100. We're thinking.
Well, and it's interesting because there are no other cities in Milwaukee County that are doing this right now. There are some other programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Waukesha has a great all-city read in Washington County, but we're happy and proud that we're the only ones in Milwaukee doing it now.
Well, and so to that end, you would probably not complain if people from outside Wauwatosa took part in this.
Oh, certainly not. And it's easy to, too, because they can access all the information on our website. All the calendar will be there, but there will also be ability to interact with other people about the book online.
Are you already looking at books, storing them away in the back of your mind for next year?
Always, always. I'm a huge reader, and I'm on the library board as well, so I have a pile of potential books for next year already.
It was an exciting thing, too, to come up with titles, and so we're looking for new titles for next year already.
Mm-hmm. A lot of pressure, too.
It is a lot of pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Maureen Batting and Robin Luther, thanks so much. Best of luck with this year's read, and best of luck down the line.
Thank you very much. Hope you read with us.
Maureen Batting and Robin Luther are organizers of the TOSA All City Read, which gets into full swing at the end of this month. There is a link to the full event schedule from wuwm.com/lake effect. The TOSA All City Read features two books, the memoir Rocket Boys by Homer Hickam and the young adult novel Hollow Earth by John and Carol Barrowman. Carol Barrowman lives in Wauwatosa. She'll join us when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we spoke with two organizers of the TOSA All City Read, which features two books organizers are hoping people will read. One is the young adult fantasy novel Hollow Earth by Wauwatosa resident Carol Barrowman and her brother, actor John Barrowman. The fast-paced novel and its sequel, Bone Quill, play out in modern-day Scotland and in the Middle Ages and feature twins Matt and Emily Calder, who share a unique trait and ability to bring things to life through drawing. Carol Barrowman is also an English professor at Alverno College, and we have brought her to life in our studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mitch. It's a pleasure.
What does it mean as an author to be part of a citywide reading initiative?
Well, first of all, it means people are stopping you everywhere you go on the street and saying, oh, I just saw your picture on this book and I've bought the book. That's really the best part of it. My neighbors are reading my book, and I think that's what's most fun. And I've gotten an opportunity to be able to get into all the schools as a result of that, which is amazing. I love talking to kids about writing and about reading, and so that's been great. But I think the biggest honor has been the fact that it's all my neighbors that are going to read my book, and I'm really thrilled about that.
Well, you're going into schools. The organizers of the All City Read, you know, talk about it from a community building standpoint, but you go into schools, and schools are kind of these built-in communities already. So I wonder if, you know, you talk to a lot of students who are assigned a lot of reading. Is part of what you get out of author visits maybe a chance to kind of spark a love for reading for pleasure?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I also think one of the things that's really important, and at least it is for me, is to encourage people to read with their families. And I think I was excited that the TOSA All City Read picked an adult book and a younger reader book, because that way you can mix and match in a way. You can read with your children and then you can read the adult one on your own. But I have to say, when I go into the schools, partly what I think an author can do is demythologize or deromanticize what it means to be a writer. When I talk to kids, they'll say, especially the younger children will say things like, are you really a writer? Because I think I look pretty normal, you know, and not in
pretty
the,
normal.
Pretty normal. Yeah. Thank you. And so I think it helps them to see that, you know, you can be a regular person. You can be a mom. You can, you know, you can be a grandma. You can be a teacher. You can be, and you can also be a writer. And the kinds of questions that, and this is the selfish part of going into the schools, the questions that I get from the children remind me of how important it is to write children's fiction with as much seriousness and literariness, if I might, as I would if I was writing an adult novel. I can give you a really good example of this. We tried to put little Easter eggs and little things in the narrative that if kids are really paying attention, they can pick up on them. It's not going to ruin the book if they don't by any means. But at the first book, Hollow Earth, is the opening little quote is from William Blake. And I was doing a presentation at the Wauwatosa Library last summer. And at the end, this little girl comes up to me. She's got the book open. She said, "You made a you write the quote for William Blake in the front of this book." And then she's flipping through the page. She said, "And on page," and I don't even remember the page, "on page like 56, you have a character whose name is Blake William. Is that deliberate?" And I took such pleasure in saying to her, "It is deliberate. And oh my gosh, you are such a good, careful reader." I don't think I had one adult reader caught the little things like that. And so for me, it reinforces my notion that our schools are working hard with these kids and they're learning and they're doing a good job with reading. And I'm really impressed when I talk to children all over, and I've talked to kids all over the country.
Well, and at the same time, I always wonder what like the authors of classic novels might think of the idea that the kids are assigned to read their books. I don't, you know, Hemingway probably did not, you know, sit there and write The Old Man and the Sea with the idea that, you know, it would torture generations of high school students.
Yeah, and college students, I must say, too. Yeah, for sure. I think that's probably – yeah, I think that that's probably true. And I think it's nice when teachers – especially – actually, I was going to say especially in the younger grades, but I think it's nice in college, too, when teachers give give their students choices, because we make choices when we read. And I think that's really important too. And it's nice if a teacher assigns something like Hollow Earth, but I think it's also nice if a kid picks it up and then goes to somebody else in the class and said, "Oh, I just read this. You'll love that." That's awfully cool too.
Well, and I wonder if we've kind of you know, those of us who you know thought of some books as being assigned and some books as being for pleasure have set up kind of this false dichotomy in our
Absolutely.
Head that there are either books, you know, there are academic books and there are fun books and that there's no overlap.
Well, and one of the things I like to tell my students is that, you know, the literature is really on a spectrum. And I always say that on one end you've got what I call French fry literature and on the other end you have French food literature. And almost every book sits somewhere in between. You know, French fries, they're delicious and tasty, but if that's all you read, you know, wouldn't be good for you. And on the other hand, there might be some, you know, French food literature that's just too heavy. And so everything is on that spectrum somewhere, which I think allows you to not deal with that dichotomy. And I still get students who will email me and say, "I read this and I didn't think I would read it. It was a French food book." And so I think that for me works, that idea that it's a sort of a spectrum. And we tend to, as we should in college, teach more that's on the French food end of that spectrum. But I think every now and then it's good to remind our people that it's okay if you're reading on that other side. Just have a balanced diet.
Well, and potentially, you know, without overanalyzing it, be able to apply what you've learned.
I'm an English professor.
Right, exactly.
Let's overanalyze
All right.
it.
So potentially be able to use what you've gotten from going through this French food diet to read the French fry literature.
Absolutely. That's exactly, you know, I think what happens is that you realize that you can analyze things that are on that other end of the spectrum with a little more detail and more thought than you can perhaps with the French food literature. But, you know, you probably want to read – I mean the French fry. I'm going to get myself confused now. French fry stuff is great for a plane, you know. Not that you can't do the other, but you want something that's you don't really have to think too much about. But
that's why you don't see a lot of Proust being read on the airplanes.
That's right. And maybe if the person sitting next to you is reading it, you know, you might – I don't know. Maybe you want to move.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it's nice to have – that kind of variety. And you know, it's funny when a lot of students in my beginning lit classes will say things like, well, we're just reading everything into this. And as a writer, I'd like to say you might read some things into it, but you know what? I've crafted this in a way that a lot of the patterns – or writers craft in a way that a lot of the patterns that you see are patterns that are deliberate.
All that said, as you look at – Hollow Earth and now Bone Quill and book number three, the name of which I don't know but is on its way to the publisher.
Well, yeah, I can tell you, and you could be the first person that I've publicly announced. It's going to be called The Book of Beasts.
Very good. And we'll talk about the significance of that in just a moment. When you look at those and you think back at the kinds of things that you read as you were growing up, were there books that you were either assigned or you just picked up that sparked something that might have shaped these books?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I think I was born and raised in Scotland, and I went through the British school system all the way up until I graduated from high school. And so my classics were a little different perhaps than your classics might have been. But I think I read a lot of things like Jane Austen I had to read in high school. Dickens we read in high school. So definitely those kinds of big Victorian novels influenced me. But I was actually, when I was a young child, was in the hospital for maybe about 6 weeks recovering from a blood disorder. And my teacher, I'll never forget her. Her name was Mrs. Silver. She was my third or fourth grade teacher at the time. And she brought me every book from her library. And I read all of them. And so I just, from then on, just couldn't get enough books. I read every Enid Blyton. I read C.S. Lewis, you know, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. But I think the book, and I hope readers might get this if when they read the third one, that really has influenced a lot of the second and the third book, more the third one, is Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth. Because Hollow Earth is underneath the islands, it's at the center of the earth. And so I hope readers who like Jules Verne might see some of that in the third one.
Well, and we should, without giving short shrift to Bone Quill, at least catch people up on the story. We're picking up where Hollow Earth left off. Twins Matt and Emily Calder are the kids of a mother who's an Anamare and a father who is a guardian. Right off the bat, remind us the significance of those two terms.
Well, Anamare are artists, some famous that we know and some that are fictional. But they're artists who, when they draw, they can bring their drawings to life and can move – the twins can move in and out of famous paintings. In Hollow Earth, the very first painting they move into that sets off all the adventures is one of Georges Seurat's paintings. And the guardians are people who have also a unique ability to what's called inspirit people. They can help. They're empaths, and they can help artists become artists so that they can control their powers and not reveal to the world that they are Anamare. Because if an Anamare were to fall into the wrong hands, think of what could happen. If everything that person could draw came to life, it would not be a good thing if that fell into the wrong hands. So in the first book, that starts all the adventures. In the second book, I don't think it's too huge of a spoiler to figure out that the twins figure out that they can time travel through particular paintings if the paintings have been drawn by an Anamare.
We haven't mentioned that they're basically staying at this monastery, which their grandfather is in charge of, and this is where, as we learned in Hollow Earth, essentially the portal to Hollow Earth is located up on the Firth of Clyde.
Yes, that's right. That's right, and set in a couple of little islands right off the western coast of Scotland. And when the children discover who they are, that they are Anamare, they flee with their mom to this abbey monastery that has its roots in the Middle Ages and has the islands themselves, the children discover in the second book, have some supernatural qualities. And Hollow Earth, they discover over the course of the two books, is a place where all the beasts and monsters that have ever been imagined in books and in stories are trapped and kept. And so it's probably no big shock for readers to think that by the time we get to the third book, we're going to head into Hollow Earth at some point. Little teaser there.
Exactly. Well, and Bone Quill leaves off with a kind of a significant cliffhanger. And it led me to wonder, how do you know when to end one of these books, given that obviously you've got to have some sense for where the story is going to go?
Well, and I think it's really a great question because it's a very hard thing to do. And I think it's one of the things that I have learned from writing this series. When John and I plotted this out, my brother John and I sort of plotted this out together and did all of the outlining for the three. We actually had the three books plotted at the very beginning. We thought this should happen in the first book. We want to build their powers so they time travel in the second book. And then something else really cool occurs in the third book. And we knew where we wanted it to end. Some readers, if you're reading carefully, there's enough foreshadowing that I'm hoping, obviously, if the book opens with them in a piece of art, there's a good chance it's going to close with something big happening in a piece of art. And the arc, when we were dividing it up, I had actually planned another chapter to end Hollow Earth. And our editor came back and she said, let's cut it off right here. Let's cut it off right here and have this be the beginning of the third one and leave this cliffhanger because it's too important and too big. And let's let it sit there. So I have to say it was another reader that helped, an editor that helped figure out where that break would be. I was going to find a little more resolution as we went on from there. I also was going to actually – I wanted to kill off a particular character at the end of the second book, and John and I went back and forth with that for quite a while because he was adamant that that we not do that. So,
and as the second book closes, we don't know.
You don't know. And so I'm not going to say what happens. I think people will be surprised and delighted and maybe a little shocked at where the third book goes. But I hope they're surprised by who ends up being the big hero at the end of the second book, because I think it's not usual. I'm trying not to give it away,
yeah.
But I think it's not usual that kind of character, at least,
has such a pivotal role.
Yeah.
And at the same time, given the cliffhanger nature of the end of this, there's a certain responsibility to get the next one out pretty quickly.
Absolutely. And you have young children. You know that when they get engaged in a story, they want to know the next thing, that they want to know something's coming. And a lot of young readers will not even pick up a first book if they don't think that there's two or three more coming because they get so attached to the characters that they want to know, they can live with them for a little longer.
Oh, well, Carol Barrowman, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Hope we'll see you and your brother back in these studios soon.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. It's a pleasure.
Wauwatosa writer Carol Barrowman is the co-author, along with her brother John Barrowman, of the young adult fantasy novels Hollow Earth and Bone Quill. Hollow Earth is one of two selections for the first ever TOSA All-City Read. You'll find a link to our 2012 interview with Carol and John Barrowman at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Wednesday's show. I'm Mitch Teich. So glad you could listen today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.